coming to our session today on building an exchange between politics and science and really moving from barriers to synergy and using data to enhance substance abuse prevention. As most of you probably know, this is a session that is sponsored by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section within APHA. We encourage you to go to their table in the exhibit hall. They have kind of a nice booklet of all the sessions that are being sponsored by this section, organized by day and by theme. So I'd encourage you to pick up one of those if you're interested in other panels and other presentations that are sponsored by the section. At that table, there's also some flyers that you can pick up about some late-breaking issues or events, including tomorrow morning. There's a new session that was added, the Surgeon General's Call to Action to Prevent and Reduce Underage Drinking. So there's a flyer that you can pick up with more information on that session, which I think is tomorrow morning. Yeah, tomorrow from 8:30 to 10. And then there's also a flyer that you can pick up regarding some of their awards and other social events that are occurring during the conference this week. So my name is Renee Boothroyd, and myself and Joe Berkmeyer work at the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, or PIER, and we've been working with a number of state epidemiological work groups across the United States. In states, jurisdictions, tribes, all with kind of an overall theme of using data to enhance substance abuse prevention. And that's really the context for today's session. We're going to begin with kind of an overview and some introductory information to set the stage, and then that will be followed by today three states who are going to present more case examples of the work that they've been doing to use data for some of the substance abuse prevention decision making. Our colleague from North Carolina wasn't able to make it this afternoon, so we will have a little bit extra time for interactions and questions with the folks that are here. And it'll pretty much go in the order that was outlined in your program guide. So, as I mentioned, the context for today's talks are really guided by these state epidemiological work groups and this idea of using data to guide decision-making for substance abuse prevention. You know, we're really in an age, as most of you are probably very acutely aware of limited resources, limited time, expectations for changing outcomes, expectations with regard to accountability for your process and really demonstrating change. And even amidst that context, there's really few states who are able to monitor substance use and related consequences, including the substantial health, social, economic, and other kinds of ramifications of alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use. There are a variety of reasons, including lack of data infrastructures, different systems, other analytical capacities of people and organizations to really use data for these decision making. But we also really want to stress that the context for this data-guided decision-making isn't built solely on data alone. That data alone are really insufficient for really moving this kind of a system forward. You know, there are a number, as I'm sure most of you are aware, of national resources, data sets, many of which make certainly state and some sub-state data available. But even in the presence of those and then others within states that folks might be looking at, we really need deliberate strategies for synthesizing and translating data, but we also need deliberate activities to really frame data to guide applications and their use by decision makers. And that could be a whole host of decision makers at state, community, and other kinds of levels. So we really asked ourselves this question of how can we build such data systems to really promote an exchange between, in this case, politics or practice, and science, and how we can use information from science and information from data to help us enhance substance abuse practice. So really the context, again, that has set up us moving forward throughout this afternoon's panel are these epidemiological work groups that are funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, or SAMHSA-CSAP. In many cases, these epidemiological work groups are a structural component of these SPIF-SIG initiatives, or the Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grants. And since about 2004, there are a total of 42 of these EPI work groups that are part of these SPIF-SIG initiatives, which is kind of another way of saying there's a data component to really guide multi-million implementation dollars within a state and to help guide and inform the allocation of those dollars to really set communities up for moving outcomes and being accountable for their change process. Since about 2006, there have been about 23 other states, jurisdictions, and tribes who have received supportive funding for an epidemiological work group. So if an area wasn't a recipient of one of these SPIF-SIG initiatives, they've also been able to receive somewhere between roughly around $200,000 to support an epidemiological work group at that state, jurisdiction, or tribe level to also begin some of that data assessment, kind of a deliberate process for really understanding alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use and consequences at those state, jurisdiction, and tribe levels, and how to then move from there in terms of enhancing those data systems. But in both cases, these EPI work groups are really networks of agencies, organizations, and people with expertise to really advance data-guided decisions about substance abuse prevention, and that kind of spans a process from assessment to planning to using data to guide an implementation process, and certainly then ongoing monitoring and other kinds of evaluation efforts. So if we take a look across the country, the colored boxes, which are kind of organized by region here, denote the EPI work groups that are part of those SPIF-SIG initiatives. And there's different cohorts, some that started in 2004, 2005, and 2006. But as I mentioned, there are about 42 of those EPI work groups that are a structural component of those SPIF-SIG initiatives. And then the unshaded or uncolored areas are the places that have also received those contract dollars to support an EPI work group. And they're very focused on an assessment component and then kind of designing monitoring systems and monitoring functions to use that data to enhance the prevention system. Okay. We got a little freeze going on. Oh, God, now it's really going to catch up. Okay, that's a lesson learned for the rest of the panelists. Be patient. One of the key principles that really informs this data-guided approach across these epidemiological work groups is what's called outcome-based prevention, kind of a simplistically, maybe on paper at least, organized kind of outcome logic model approach for beginning by looking at that substance use and related consequence data and really getting a solid understanding of what do the problems look like, what are priorities as it relates to this epidemiological data, and moving through that kind of approach to then understand the factors that are causing or contributing to those problems before we start talking about strategies, those programs, policies, and practices to really then do something about those factors and ultimately target priorities as it relates to substance use and related consequences. So the aim here is really to guide not only effective prevention strategies, but relevant prevention strategies that are really framed by and informed by that understanding of the prevalence and patterns of alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use and the factors that really contribute to them. So these epidemiological work groups have really been grounded in kind of that first box in this outcome-based prevention approach of really at that state, jurisdiction, and tribe level, beginning by understanding substance use and related consequences. So some of the key tasks and initial kind of milestones, if you will, at least some of the initial ones that have really framed the work of these epidemiological work groups include kind of first and foremost kind of startup, developing this group in terms of membership and procedures and communication and just the process of going about how to come together and then move forward in this data-guided approach. In some cases, those were revamped, maybe rebirthed, efforts that had been in existence a year or a few years ago in terms of this kind of approach. In some cases, these were brand new groups, so new relationships, folks that even said to each other, we should have been working on this all along, but we really hadn't come together in terms of this shared data kind of approach. But really just this idea of kind of putting a structure and a membership together. Another key task was certainly to determine data needs, if you will. What are the set of constructs and indicators across alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, and really across the lifespan, which was different for a lot of folks to begin to explore. They had been relying perhaps more so on youth data. But where else can we look to really understand what substance use and related consequences look like? And those might be, again, some new and strengthening relationships. But there's real variety in how organizations and individuals went forward there. Pulling all that together then and really being able to describe what the epidemiology of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs looked like and putting that into kind of a data product, which for many folks was kind of a formal state epidemiological profile, which in some cases built on maybe something that they had started. In other cases, maybe was dusting off and updating something that hadn't been able to be updated in the past. And in other cases, was something that was brand new, that was really going to be kind of a value added to the state and to other partners that were really trying to adopt this kind of data-guided approach. And there have been a number of other kinds of data products, community epi profiles, some tip sheets in terms of methodological and other kinds of data limitations that have really been used to help folks really wrap their heads around how do we summarize and analyze and use this data for decision making. And in particular with the case of these SPIF-SIG initiatives, again, they have implementation dollars to allocate to communities. These EPI work groups have been playing, in some cases different, but certainly very important roles and helping the states, the jurisdictions, and tribes really define from that comprehensive description, that EPI profile, what are the priorities that the state or the tribe or the jurisdiction will address. Because certainly if you put together a profile, the expectation is they're not going to be able to address everything in terms of prevention. So how do we help states focus in terms of what to address that's informed by the data? And then use that data to inform other components of a plan that the state or jurisdiction or tribe is expected to put together before they can make those allocations within the state or within the jurisdiction or tribe. So visually, the way that looks, especially in terms of an assessment process and across this outcomes-based prevention model, is that, or framework, is that the states and the jurisdictions and tribes are developing this profile, again, based on and framed by the substance use and related consequence data. And then they're going through a process, a kind of funneling process, if you will, to really then focus and define, often in a participatory way, and definitely as framed and guided by the data, what are the priorities then that we will take action on with these SPIF-SIG dollars. And they will then use information, use indicators about those priorities, again as described by the data, to put together a plan to allocate dollars to address them. And then, and only then, will communities then play a crucial role in continuing to implement this process of assessment and planning to really then understand, first to kind of locally define if the priority is underage drinking for the state, then what does that look like in my community in terms of demographics, in terms of place, in terms of other kinds of features, and then to really unpack the factors that are contributing to that problem so that, again, communities can be engaging in a process to define not only effective but relevant prevention strategies to do something about the problem as defined locally in their community. And this is where then, in terms of some of these data-guided decisions, that a number of integrations, if you will, between politics or practice and science can certainly overlap. Here are some examples of those kind of constructs, things like mortality, crime, other kinds of consequences, across substances by type, of where states and jurisdictions and tribes began some of their data assessment. And there are decisions made here in terms of what data, what sources, based on what criteria. Certainly some tensions regarding data ownership, perhaps histories of using certain data and not others as a system surfaced. But this was kind of the first place where through those collaborative and participatory efforts, some decisions were being made about if we're going to address this question of what do alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use and related consequences look like, we need to make some decisions about what data. And so that was one of the first places where those overlaps came into play. A second place where some politics or practice and science really met was in determining those priorities. Because as I mentioned, the availability of data doesn't necessarily lead to decisions without some deliberate strategies on which to then base decisions about that. So states and jurisdictions and tribes were going from kind of an overall sense of broadly what do substance use and related consequences look like down to a sense of going through a process as well as using a number of criteria to then define, so what are the prevention priorities that we will address? And they used epidemiological criteria as well as other criteria through a real range of processes for decision making. Some very kind of qualitative approaches where some scoring, even some formula helped to guide those decisions. Some were qualitative, nominal group, other kinds of community input into some group discussions to make those decisions. But ultimately, they were going from kind of a comprehensive sense down to a real focused sense in terms of priorities. And again, as I mentioned, they were looking at magnitude in terms of the number of cases, rates, proportions, trends over time, relative comparisons, comparing state rates to other peer state rates. A lot of New England states explored those kind of relative comparisons. They might have looked at their state rates compared to U.S. or Healthy People 2010 benchmarks. Some folks also looked at things like years of potential life lost or quality adjusted or disability adjusted life years to get a sense of what does severity look like as it relates to some of this data. And some were able to begin to look at some of the economic or other kinds of social impact. But again, their use of certain criteria or dimensions, if you will, to make decisions, we might have been talking about objective data, but this became a subjective process in terms of perhaps making some of those decisions about what to use, how to apply them in a decision-making process, and on the other end of it, how to interpret what you got in terms of a decision and how that then kind of informed decisions about priorities. Some other criteria besides epidemiological dimensions also informed this prioritization. Some information about capacity and resources, issues like human, institutional, and other kinds of financial resources, features related to the overall preventability and changeability, or looking at things like evidence and feasibility of change. In other words, if states were faced with a handful of priorities and really wanted to hone in, they might use some additional criteria, as well as things like readiness and political will, things like public concern, political kind of readiness. And again, you can probably already begin to think about how some of these issues might inform, sometimes switch, a prioritization process that might have even been based on some of the data. So states really worked through a process to figure out what to apply and how to apply it and to what degrees. In this case, we really were encouraging states to look at additional dimensions within the context of need that was already defined by some of the epi dimensions. At this point, as of a couple weeks ago, about 26 of the grantees having identified their priority, 17, I didn't update that part of the slide, but about 17 sites have selected alcohol as their sole priority. In many cases, an underage drinking focus, in some cases additional focuses on youth and young adults, and in some cases some focus on adult binge drinking. And some of them have looked at not only the consumption pattern as their priority, but also its overlap with certain consequences like alcohol-related crash fatalities and injuries, alcohol-related crime, and other kind of consequences that really just reinforced for them that this was a priority that they wanted to address that was guided by their data, as well as other kinds of criteria. An additional 9 sites who have also selected alcohol have also selected one or more substances, in some cases tobacco, other kinds of illicit drugs that are named here, and in some cases non-medical use of prescription drugs. So you can kind of see the variety and even kind of predict, if you will, how arriving at some of these decisions might have been certainly informed by the data, but possibly even problematic, where some states may be expected to be focusing on issue A, and then they ended up focusing on issue B for a variety of reasons that were informed by their process. Some cases that was a very much a learning experience, and in other cases it was wrought with some points of frustration that I might let some others elaborate on. Again, keeping in mind that this is often a collaborative and participatory process, and data was one piece of the decision making. The final kind of piece in general where some of this data-guided decision-making unfolded was as it relates to planning. And this is just a table that then summarizes how some data might go forward or has gone forward as priorities were then defined. Again, based on some of their epi data about consequences and consumption patterns, as a state or a tribe or jurisdiction is putting together their overall SPIF-SIG plan, they need to make a case for using data about that priority and how information about that priority is informing how they're going to allocate funds. So an indicator of that priority would be used to allocate or to propose how to then invest across the state in terms of communities so that what they want to change is actually connected to their approach for allocating resources. And they would fold that into a method or a mechanism for then distributing those funds. For example, it might be used, data about a priority might be used to define eligible communities in terms of a certain cutoff of data, or data about a priority might be used to review and score applications that came in terms of degree of need or other kinds of features. And then a state or a jurisdiction or a tribe would articulate their number of kind of community subrecipients. And again, based on that data, begin to propose what they expected to change at community and state levels and comment on their capacity to support those kind of change efforts. So here's just a brief example with the state of Texas, where they had identified binge drinking among ages 12 to 25-year-olds as their priority, again, guided by their data and their decision-making process up until that point. And they adopted what we call the highest contributor model, where what they were trying to do was target areas within the state, because it's a big state, and an equity model might not really result in the kind of change that they wanted to achieve, where they were targeting areas with the highest numbers of cases. In their case, they didn't have sub-state consumption data on which to base that kind of approach, so they used a proxy in their alcohol-involved drivers and fatal crashes and identified counties in the state that had 50 or more cases during a certain time period, and they selected those places with the greatest number among their target age for binge drinking. Now, in their case, an RFP was a state requirement, and they were able to open the process to the 7 highest contributor counties, again, using a data-informed process. For some states, this might not be a reality, so they might have then opened it up and then used that information to make some decisions. But as you can kind of see, there was this data-guided approach then, where they used information about their priority to inform how they made those funds available and how much they made available to certain places. So, some initial observations then, that these data-guided decision-making approaches are really bringing public health and substance abuse prevention together, where maybe some of those relationships weren't as clear before. helping to really bridge and look across all substances and really guiding prevention with a focus on outcomes, which has been a challenge for some places. That this has really framed a foundation for a monitoring system and some ideas to really improve that kind of approach. And it really resulted in building some in and out of house data capacities, and that has some pros and cons in and of itself in terms of sustainability. And infusing data into a kind of decision-making structure, again, with multiple stakeholders, and how that can have some strengths and challenges in and of itself. So what we wanted to do this afternoon, then, was, through some case examples, describe some epidemiological work group structures and the processes that they've used to really make this concrete for using data to inform their substance abuse prevention decisions, and to begin to examine the application of some of those parameters and processes that they use to draw inferences from their data and inform those decisions. And excited to hear about some of their comments about realities and challenges and emergent lessons throughout that process. So, bear with me as the system thinks.